Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, I want to bring you the story for this hour of an American man who died this week at the age of 81. He brought joy to pop music and untold misery to so many lives. When people talk about record producers, I suppose George Martin's got to be top of the list. You know, he didn't just produce 95% of the Beatles' music. He basically added so much to what made the Beatles unique. But apart from him, in the fame game, Phil Spector is right up there. He elevated the craft of producing pop singles to something close to an art. Tom Wolfe called him the first tycoon of teen. He was born near the beginning of the Second World War into a first-generation immigrant Jewish family in the Bronx in New York City. His father, who committed suicide in 1949, had emigrated from the Ukraine and the US. Phil Spector got involved in music at high school, and by the age of 21, he was a millionaire. That's about 8 million quid, or 8 million dollars anyway, in today's money. He made his money, he made his fame, he made his career as a producer of music. But his real legacy? Well, he may have changed the sound of music in the 60s, but ultimately he was a deranged sociopath who cold-bloodedly murdered an actress who he met one night in 2003 and invited back to his LA home. Phil Spector, serving a 19-year prison sentence, he died this week in Stockton Prison in California from COVID-19. So what about those who worked with him? Just how crazy was Phil Spector? I mean, he produced songs from the 60s with his famous over-the-top wall of sound. He produced Leonard Cohen, The Ramones and Star Sailor. And he was married to Ronnie Spector from The Ronettes. I'm going to talk to all of those in this hour in the programme. But first, here's a small example of some of the sounds he made.
You're trying.
Right, there's an awful lot there that you'll know, all right. And 51552 is our text, and it's coming up to 11 minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock. So let's take a look at one or two of the people that he did work with. Leonard Cohen, he ditched his usual minimalist style, as evidenced on his first four albums, for his fifth release called Death of a Ladies' Man. There was ornate arrangements here and multiple instrumental overdubs there. Phil Spector was the producer on all of that. And here's Leonard Cohen talking about the experience.
I spoke to Ronnie Spector on the programme some time back, and she had these really terrible stories about her ex-husband. You did Death of a Ladies' Man with him. It's an album that a lot of people will talk to you about because they can put a handle on that one. They might miss out on You Came for the Old Ceremony or Reese's right. Songs, whatever, but they'll hone in on Death of a Ladies' Man because of the Phil Spector stories that go with right. it. Do you look upon it as a sort of an interesting experiment that sort of gets a thumb sideways as opposed to a thumbs up or a thumbs down, that it could have maybe been better without Phil Spector?
Well, it could have been better without Leonard Cohen. You know, I think that the
track... Well, it was with that Leonard Cohen at the end, wasn't it?
More or less, yeah. But I mean, at a certain point, I even suggested to Phil, I think, that he's singing. He's a good singer, Phil, incidentally. Nobody knows that. But I felt it took a different kind of singer, a more powerful singer. I think I could do it now. I think it could handle it now. But I think that record would have been a great record without Leonard Cohen. I think if it had had Bill Medley on it or... you know, one of the Righteous Brothers or something like that, or Aaron Neville, let's say, today, yeah, that kind of voice.
Somebody who could give him a wall of sound. And
sometimes, yeah, somebody who could really, you know, climb that wall and walk on it like the China Wall and rejoice on top of that wall. It would have been a grand piece of work. As it was, I don't think I had the chops to meet it.
But at the same time, like, the circumstances were pretty strange. I mean, how crazy was the scene? Guns.
It was crazy as you can possibly imagine. I mean, it was crazier than I thought at the time. Looking back on it, I see that, you know, everybody was around the bend. I mean, Phil was around the bend, and I was around the bend for being there. You know, my own life was breaking up, and God knows what was happening to him because he was over the hill. You know, I mean, everybody was armed. I mean, you know, you'd slip on bullets. I mean, there were, you know, your hamburger was full of guns. I mean, you know, everywhere you turned, there was a gun. And, you know, and that would have been bad enough, but everybody was drunk, too, you know. And I remember Phil pulled a gun on the fiddle player, you know, in the song Fingerprints. And he was a country boy, and he just stood up and put his fiddle in the case and walked out. Mm-hmm. And Phil approached me with a bottle of Manischewitz red wine, and that's a kosher wine, sweet wine. You wouldn't want to drink it. I don't know what Phil was drinking it. And 45 and the other put his arm around my shoulder and muzzled the gun into my neck and said, I love you, Leonard. You know, I said, I hope you do, Phil.
Yeah, it's Leonard Cohen talking about Phil Spector. And May Pang, I want to go to next. She gets a chapter all to herself in the history of rock and roll. She was a former music executive who worked as personal assistant and production coordinator with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And then when Yoko separated from John for a couple of years, Lennon and May Pang began a relationship that lasted for a year and a half. There were wild times around 73 and 74, an awful lot of nights in the town, a lot of crazy LA carry-on, an awful lot of famous names in the mix, including Phil Spector. John Lennon refers to that time as his lost weekend. May Pang herself has written two books about that time, and I spoke with her some time back all about the time that things were pretty strange in the mid-1970s.
May, it's nice to talk to you.
Well, it's nice to talk to you too.
Okay, May, just to fill in who May Pang is, you've been a name in music actually down through quite a few years. Spanish Harlem in New York, you knew the music like doo-wop and street corner music and Dion and the Belmonts, just like Phil Spector. Beatles 64 Invasion meant an awful lot to you, and by 1970 you decided, I got to work in this business. So you did, and you got into work in the Beatles office in New York, and suddenly you were PA to John and Yoko, personal assistant. Pretty soon afterwards, Yoko decided to take a break from John, and you were what? Were you the third woman? Were you the woman in the way? Were you the woman in the lost weekend?
I was the woman in the lost weekend. I think that's what they referred to me as.
And this lost weekend lasted for about 18 months. So who are we talking about here? Are we talking about Harry Nilsson? Are we talking about Phil Spector? Are we talking about you? Are we talking about John Lennon?
We're talking about all those people, I think. You know, they were all there. I mean, you know, Phil Spector, I mean, with the thing that just happened to him is absolutely, it was more of a shock, not surprise, but a shock. He used to come over to our house when he wanted to rehearse with John, and he used to carry his guns. John and I always used to think that it was, filled with blanks, you know. He had a bodyguard, so we didn't think it was real. And then one day he shot it off in the studio, and John still thought, you know, God, Phil, you know, if you're going to shoot me, but don't shoot it so that I can't hear. I need those ears. He said in a different way, but basically that was the gist
right.
of it.
And this was a few years after the Imagine album. This is the rock and roll album.
This was the rock and roll album started in 1973. So this was started in 1973 in the fall.
Right. And I Phil Spector actually shot off a gun in the studio. Did he come in with guns and holsters?
Yeah, when he used to come to our place where we stayed, he had two guns in their holsters. And so, you know, he carried them around their shoulders. It wasn't around the waist, it was around the shoulders. And, you know, John and I were, like, not happy about it, but that's what Phil would carry. I mean, you know, you couldn't tell him to take it off. He just wouldn't have it. And when he shot it off the next day, you know, after this whole thing had happened, you know, Mal Evans came in. We were in a restaurant eating, and Mal says, "Oh, well, here's a bullet from last night." And we said, "What bullet?"
Wow. So that was when you found out it was real?
Yeah.
Wow. Listen, I mean, at that time, I mean, like, I know later on you married Tony Visconti, and now you're with Tom Scott, who, by the way, is a band. is that the same Tom Scott from LA Express?
Yes, it is.
I saw Tom Scott, LA Express, with Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, in some place in New York in about 1974.
That's about right. That would be about. And then, you know what, he's either 73, because in, well, late 74, he was with George Harrison on the Dark Horse
Tour. That's right, exactly, George Harrison.
Oh, yeah, no, and Tom, you know, and I only met him during the George Harrison tour, but he was actually in the studio across the hall with Joni at A&M Studios in 73. And he remembers seeing his friends, his musician friends, and everybody just and hearing what was going on. He said, I stayed away from there. He said, I wouldn't go near that studio.
Okay, but yeah, May, the thing is that, like, when we hear about those 18 months of, or thereabouts, of the lost weekend of Harry Nilsson and of Phil Spector and of John Lennon.
And Elton John and David Bowie, exactly,
yeah. And I mean, like, and Ringo, of course, as well.
And Paul McCartney.
Okay, we hear about you as, like, were you girlfriend to John Lennon at the time?
Yeah, I was his girlfriend. We lived together. We didn't tell anybody in the beginning, but it slowly leaked out. I mean, you know, John and I, we didn't hide it. We weren't hiding it. And then just, in fact, it hit the British press months before it hit the American press. Mm. And in the American press, it happened when photos were taken of us when we went to the famous Smothers Brothers.
That's the night that John went completely over the top. Yeah,
well,
right.
I think, I blame partly more on that when Harry kept ordering drinks and started heckling everyone.
That's right. Harry Nilsson got into big trouble for that night.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
But I mean, like, is it true that at some stage around that time that Phil Spector actually tied John Lennon up in the studio?
That was back in months before that. That was in 73. And it was one of those drunken nights, and Phil, we stopped the studio, we stopped the recording, we all came back to our place where we were staying, and we were staying at Lou Adler's house at the time. And we were in the house, and Jim Keltner and Jesse Ed Davis, they brought him in and everything. And for some reason, in that drunkenness, Phil and his bodyguard assistant, George, took John's glasses away from him. And, you know, John, without his glasses, couldn't see a thing, and he didn't know what was going on. And they were all drunk out of their mind. So, and then all of a sudden, Phil tied him up with neckties and whatever. And he said, he called to me, and he said, and I looked, and I saw John tied up, and I freaked. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Leave him alone. He's just drunk. He'll let it. He'll be fine in the morning."
Mm.
And I said, and I walked out, and he was screaming, and I felt so bad, and I knew that if I, not knowing who I was at that point, it was one blurred situation for John. I immediately ran to the phone. He left us, and his girlfriend and I were in the house, and she said, "Oh, everything will be fine." I said, no, I'm calling." So I called up Tony King, who was general manager for Apple, who was in LA at the time. I called him up, said, "Please come by. I need you." And then I called up Roy Sakala and his assistant Jimmy Iovine at the time to come over too. I said, you know, it was just chaos. I said, because as a person, I knew that I was overwhelmed. I said, and I didn't know what to do.
Okay, well then, May, I mean, like, Phil Spector, I mean, the general opinion down through the years is that he's at least, like, a paradiddle short of a drum solo. Like, bonkers. you know him. Is he bonkers?
You know, I guess in my book, he would be a little off. You know, that's definite, you know? but, you know, but then again, everybody's off in
sure,
their own different
sure,
way.
Sure, sure, sure. Absolutely, yeah.
So,
absolutely.
You know, somebody else would say, "That's normal. I've done it." You know, Keith Moon would probably say that was he was normal.
I'd say he would, actually.
Right,
yeah,
so it depends on who's looking at it.
Sure.
You know?
Listen, by the way, were you saddened big time by the news this week?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's awful. I mean, you know, you don't want to hear any of these things. It's so long ago.
What I actually meant was saddened and maybe not too surprised.
No, not surprised at all.
Yeah,
not,
exactly.
Definitely not surprised. I mean, but you know what? I would have thought over the years, and I hadn't seen him because the last time I saw him, he saw me in fact, it was at a U2 concert at Yankee Stadium, and I saw him there, and I went up and I said hello, and he just gave me this look, and I think if looks could kill, it was probably that was it, and I don't know why, but he just gave me this look, and I turned around, and he wouldn't even answer me, and I turned around and I said, "You know what, Phil? You know, have yourself a good life," and I walked away.
Right,
and,
indeed.
And that was the last. But that during that week, apparently, he was in the newspaper for hitting some woman journalist.
Really?
So, I mean, you know, that's what it was in the papers. And I said, "Well, you know what? I don't know. But I am not, I'm not surprised."
Not surprised. That's May Pang talking around the time that Phil Spector was arrested. That was about, 2003, 2004. That was the first time. Anyway, what I was going to say, 22 minutes, 23 minutes nearly past the hour of 1 o'clock. And we're talking about Phil Spector, who died this week. 51552 is our text. And we'll talk to Phil Spector's wife a little bit later on. But one of the great pleasures of my life was to be in the same room talking to all four of the Ramones, one of my all-time favourite bands. All four, by the way, passed away this century. In 1980, they released their fifth album, The Ramones. It's called End of the Century. It was a departure from the first four and not a massively successful one from my point of view. Phil Spector gave them a bigger, newer, fuller sound, and it worked. You know, they got their daytime radio play, but at a certain cost, I think, to what made them great. Anyway, I'll just give you a little bit of a blast of that, of The Ramones, talking about their experience with Phil Spector.
And what about the one before that then? I mean, like, working with Phil Spector. I saw a thing on Phil Spector on television, and it was one of these real sort of, isn't he wonderful and isn't he a genius, and he might be a bit mad, but he's definitely brilliant and all this sort of thing. And the only person to really sort of lay into him was you. Do you feel like, was the Phil Spector experience a bad one in some ways?
I don't think there are most people working with Phil Spector either. I mean, you should be working with somebody who knows how to put out a hard record. Phil Spector's just it's a legend in his time, but his time was a long time ago.
Well, was it a mistake then to get Phil Spector?
Well, yes and no.
No.
There's there's pros on it, and there's a lot of cons on it. You know, he didn't really make a good record, but at the time, we felt that he did sort of understand us in a way. He knew all the stuff that we were doing, and we felt that maybe he would open up some radio possibilities, even though still playing our songs. And it just didn't really work out properly. But
it was like very important for him in his own mind, in a sense, to do it. And the last thing he had done, I guess, was the John Lennon Rock and Roll album. And he came out of retirement and the whole bit, you know.
I don't think he'll ever finish another record. I think we had a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, record companies put a lot of pressure on you to come up with a producer. And, you know, they're not satisfied with you selling X amount of records. You know, that's never good enough for them, you know. Even if they can make money off of the amount that you're selling, they always need to have you had to sell more. Instead of just concentrating on making a good record, and that's what they should be concerned about.
It was real controversial, you know, like everything else we've done, and you either loved it or hated it. You know, actually, I enjoy working with Spector. I mean, I found him enlightening, in a sense, you know. But it was difficult. He is nuts, and, you know, the legend is true and the whole bit, you know.
Yeah, Phil Spector produced Rock and Roll High School. That's music there from the Ramones, of course. 51552 is our text. We're taking a look at Phil Spector, who died this week in California in jail. The Ronettes, of course, they had a bunch of fantastic sounding big hits in the 1960s. It was Phil Spector who created the sound. The Ronettes broke up in 67, and the front person and lead singer Ronnie married Spector in 68, and Spector subjected her to years of psychological torment. So Phil Spector's wife, Ronnie Spector, here's an interview that I did with her.
It was almost a love at first sight, wasn't it, in some ways? I mean, you were mesmerised by this guy.
Well, the first night I met him at that Mirasan with the other two Ronettes, he played us a song called by Darlene Love, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, which I thought was weird because we kept looking at each other over this grand piano that he had, and I was very shy. And it was weird that he was looking at me, I'm looking at him, and then a couple of nights later, me and the other two Ronettes would go down and rehearse, and then he would tell them to go home, and we'd rehearse alone, and that's when it started. So I'd say from the very beginning.
Do you think from the very beginning, in some ways, that was also the beginning of the end for the Ronettes, because there was too much with you? I mean, there was one description in the book about how the food used to come out and yours would be on the bottom to keep your one hot.
Yeah, well, that's when the jealousy started with the other two Ronettes. I remember Phil, you know, like we would be in a hotel and, you know, after a long night at the studio, and he would come in and say, here's your food, guys, and Ronnie's is on the bottom because that's the warmest. Well, the other two Ronettes, and another thing he would do was he would keep me on the phone all night. So they were jealous because their boyfriends weren't calling them, and it just got crazy at one point. But I think the end of the Ronettes was when Phil and I started our romance. Mm. And I hated that because I didn't see it then. And I loved the Ronettes, and I loved performing.
But, I mean, by that stage, that was a good 3 years before you married Phil. And yet there was plenty of signs that Phil was, to put it bluntly, a bit of a weirdo even then, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I thought once I married Phil, things would calm down because I knew he was this genius and he worked hard and he stayed up all night arranging things and writing things. So I knew that and I accepted that and I loved him. But I thought that once we got married, things would change. He would calm down. He wouldn't be so jealous. He would know it's him and me forever. You know, I'm still living in this fantasy world. And love is blind. You don't see a lot of the things that other people see. Like the other two Ronettes would say, can't you see that he's holding you down from doing everything? He's calling you to make sure you don't go out and see other guys and stuff. And you don't see that? I said, no, he loves me is why he's calling me. You guys be quiet. So it was like I didn't see a lot of the things to it was too late.
Yeah, but even like before that, your mother was able to say, look, this is ridiculous. This guy's supposed to be the millionaire. And like this guy was one of the most famous people in the history. In fact, he still is. What am I talking about? One of the most famous people in the history of music. He was a millionaire by the age of 21. I mean, even in the 70s.
Giving him our allowance money.
Even in the 70s, like when he produced albums for, say, Leonard Cohen or the Ramones, there was much more talk about Phil Spector producing them than about the albums themselves or about the two acts I've just mentioned. So if he wasn't spending any money, he used to make you sort of scrape up all the pennies together to sort of paved the ride
home. I remember that very clearly. I remember the Ronettes going, it would take us to lunch or something, and after lunch he would say, guys, I only have a $100 bill. So we were just getting out of high school.
The
so
old $100 bill trick.
We didn't know that was a trick then. I mean, we were in awe of him. The first time I ever saw a limousine was when I met Phil Spector. The first time I ever had room service or big hotels is when I met Phil. Remember, I'm from Spanish Harlem, and when I was downtown, I didn't go in the Plaza or the Waldorf Hotel. I only looked at it from the outside. So all of this was like, my God. So I was in awe of Phil myself. And so were the other two, Ron. That's not like me, but, you know, you're in awe of this man that has limousines. And I remember a show called The Millionaire in New York, and it was on when we used to come home from school. That was a show we watched. It was about a millionaire who gave $1 million to somebody he liked or treated. And that's all we knew of a millionaire. And Phil was a millionaire when we met him and considered a genius. Mm-hmm. So we were, you know, very much in awe, especially me, that he made a hit record, number one. Ooh, wow, wow.
Okay, so if like Phil was also very jealous. I mean, even in those early days, I'm still talking way before you got married here now.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Just take Cher. Something I didn't know about, that Cher did a lot of backing vocals in those days.
Sonny and Cher.
Yeah.
They did all of them.
Yeah,
all of the backings from Be My Baby. Not just my records, the Righteous Brothers stuff, Darling Love stuff, the Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans.
I knew she did some, but I didn't realize she did so many until I read the book. But the first time you met Cher, you thought she was a hooker.
Yeah. Well, the first time I met, we had to meet Sonny upstairs in a hotel room. Sonny had the piano. They always rented hotel rooms, and they had a piano rented and stuff for us to learn records. This is before Phil moved to California, and all his studio work was in Gold Star. And Cher was there with Sonny this day. And I remember she had this eyeliner, this blue stuff, and tight pants. And I actually thought she was a hooker. People thought I was a hooker too once, so in the book, don't think I'm saying that about Cher, because I love her and we're great friends. And also that I people thought I was a hooker once too, so I almost got arrested.
That's in the book
Phil.
As well. That was a really odd
hotel,
one. And who set up that arrest? Phil. Did he?
You think so? No.
Well, I don't know. Judging, reading between the lines, I get that impression. No? I mean, he was really like irate afterwards. How dare you? Do you realize that's my wife, sort of thing? But at the same time, it happened when you were walking down the corridor. You didn't know what was going on. The cops pulled you in, right?
Yes, and Phil had left just 5 minutes prior to me. Yeah. But I never thought of him as doing tricks and this and that to get me or make me. I don't know why I didn't think of him like that. I always thought of him as a sweet guy. I didn't see the other side until after I was married. I saw some of it before I was married, but not like I saw after I was married.
And when you were married and living in California in your mansion in Beverly Hills or whatever, which it was, right?
Yes.
Okay.
23 rooms and 5 servants.
Really?
Yeah.
But yet you were a prisoner.
Well, I wasn't anything. I was just, there's the cook, there's the upstairs maid, there's wife. You understand? I'm right in that category somewhere. And that's how I felt.
Is it a bit like Foster Kane in Citizen? What's his name? Thingamabob and Citizen Kane.
Orson Welles.
Was it a bit like that?
I have to tell you something, Dave. As a matter of fact, the movie Citizen Kane, we had a projection room in our home, and that Citizen Kane was Phil's favorite movie, and he played it over and over. And of course it was about a girl that couldn't sing. And I thought he was just so nice and in love with me to tell me in a nice way that I couldn't sing. See, so everything that he did, it was like bad. I thought that was his nice way of saying, you can't sing, I just don't want to know how to tell you, so I'll play Citizen Kane for you every night. So I just got the message. So I was a little dense too, you know.
Ronnie, just to get sort of a bit of a headline right through those few years with Phil, the 6 years you were married, it was completely and absolutely crazy, right?
Yes, it was. I mean, the first year was nice, I must say. But after that, it just got crazier, more gates, more dogs, more, more locks on the doors, locked from the inside. It just got to the point where I had to leave with no shoes on. That's the only way I could get out. And my mother had to come from New York, and we sat up and planned my escape and planned how I should get out. And the only way I could get out is if I didn't have on shoes. Phil would think that I'm not going to leave, because I wouldn't walk, past the gates and all the rocks and stuff. And that's how I got out, past the rocks and all, through me and my mom.
Wow. I mean, we don't have enough time to go through all the things about the pillow to make it look as though you were pregnant, about the cast on the leg and all these things. But when you did get out, you're talking about what, 1974, no?
1972,
but you finally got the divorce in 74.
Yes. After 74, when I got my divorce from Phil, that was the end of it. Not true. Phil called me for years and years and harassed me and said if I got on a stage, he would have hitmen and he would kill me. So it went on for years and years after my divorce till I finally met a man named Jonathan Greenfield that got the phone from Phil one night. He was just a friend of mine at the beginning. And he said, my God, how can anybody just torture a person like this? He happened to overhear Phil on the extension one night. And he told him whatever he said to him, and that was the last time Phil called. So I want people to know it wasn't after the divorce that it stopped. It got worse and worse and worse till I thought I was just, I may as well kill myself. Because he, that was, I think, his plan inside is to say, you'll do it yourself. I'll be in California and you'll be in New York and you'll kill your own self. And I got out and I'm here and I survived. And I'm alive. I have two beautiful children. They're not adopted. They're biologically mine. And I'm having a great time. I'm back with singing. I have a band that I've had for 2 years, and we're rocking and rolling. And I'm having a good time. Yes.
When was the last time you had contact with Phil?
I haven't. The last time was about a month ago because we're going through royalties. He owes me about a few million dollars in back royalties from movies that my records have been in and all that, and have been in commercials and stuff, and he never paid me. So all that, they took him to court and I won. So.
So downtown Connecticut is where it's at.
Yes.
Downtown Connecticut is where it's at. We're talking Phil Spector here on the program at the moment, and it's coming up to nearly 20 to 2. Well, I don't know, 25 to 2. What was I going to say? Yeah, 51552 is our text, and that's a former wife of Phil Spector, Ronnie Spector, talking there, and that kind of sums it all up, really, in so many ways. And the funny thing is, we had the Ramones earlier talking, and Leonard Cohen talking as well, and the Ramones album that he did around 1980, that's really it for Phil Spector, because after the Ramones album, and a very early falling out with Celine Dion's production team for her album called Falling Into You, Phil Spector wasn't credited with making any music. That's right, for the past 40 years, basically nothing. That is, except one thing. He produced two songs on the 2003 album Silence Is Easy by, above all things, English post-Britpop band Star Sailor. And then he got kicked off because it just didn't work out. So I'll tell you, I'll give you a bit of that now. This is James Walsh from Star Sailor.
Okay, well, now, one of the things about this album, Silence Is Easy, the new one from Star Sailor, James, is definitely going to be, it's going to center around a lot of the headlines around the place, around one of the producers you had in the studio with you, and that's Phil Spector, because of what's happened since with Phil Spector. So, first of all, why did you want to have a guy like that? I mean, like his famous wall of sound. I have a theory, which is probably very unfair about Phil Spector, that he was kind of washed out at the end of the 60s. And yeah. you could say, hold on a minute, he did imagine John Lennon and a lot of other things. He was often there and he ended up doing other stuff, but basically hasn't done an awful lot. So why did you want Phil Spector?
Well, it was a lot of the cases that Phil Spector wanted us, really.
Right.
Because his daughter came to a concert and really enjoyed the band, and she just said, my dad would really love your music. Played him our CD, and then he came down to a concert and said, come up to the house, and I want to talk to you about maybe doing a few tracks. So it was just an opportunity that we couldn't really pass up, because as far as I'm concerned, his album with Dion was his masterwork, apart from obviously the stuff with the Ronettes.
Right, and when you say come up to the house, is that the weird house he lives in LA?
Yeah.
And is it as weird as people say it is?
It's pretty weird.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience walking around there and picking up John Lennon's guitar and seeing he's got a montage of pictures of him with everybody from like Bruce Springsteen to Joey Ramone. And so it's quite a surreal experience.
But I mean, like, when it comes to surreal experience, the Ramones could talk for hours about the album that he made with them.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen has spoken on this program for a while about the album he made as well, because, like, you know, anybody who works with Phil Spector, the book can be written by the people who worked with him. So, I mean, for starters, was it a meeting of minds or was it two worlds colliding? And by the way, sometimes two worlds colliding in the studio is a good thing.
It was a bit of both, really. I think at times he was just amazing, the way that he could work with a string quartet and turn them into an orchestra.
Mm.
And also the way that he layered everything. He'd re-record the drums and the bass, but keep the original one and just keep tracking stuff, so it had this huge sound. But on the other side of the coin, he worked kind of inhuman hours, like from 6 till 5 in the morning or something, instead of your usual working hours. And sometimes he'd be in another world himself. Like, he'd take a few goals at sort of getting through to him some days.
Like, he was not, you weren't capable of communicating with the guy. And did you ever sit there and say, jeepers, this was a mistake? Just because his bloody daughter likes Star Sailor doesn't mean we really should have gone this far. Can we get rid of this Phil Spector guy, like, without sort of anybody knowing?
No, it never got that far.
Right. But he is unorthodox, to say the least, isn't he?
Yeah. I think what surprised us the most as well was how live he wanted everything to be.
Right.
Because obviously his reputation is for pure perfection. But with us, it was all about the moment. So he'd be like, right, he'd be coming away thinking, oh, I made a few bum notes in there and I didn't think that sounded so good. And he's like, that'll do, that's perfect. So and you'd listen back to it and agree with him, because he was really for capturing the vibe and the soul of it, and instead of the sort of meticulous perfection that he's famed for.
And there's two songs on the album, Silence Is Easy and White Dove, that were his songs. Is that right? I mean, sorry,
yeah.
That were songs that he worked on. Were there other ones that he worked on that you haven't released on the album?
There's a few that might appear as B-sides and things.
Right.
But I think those are the two songs that it worked the best on, because he's got a very rigid idea of rhythm. It's like that classic Spector rhythm. And I think that Silence Is Easy particularly suited that kind of Be My Baby, big snare drum sound.
James, when he was famous, you were like not even, your parents hadn't even met. I mean, like, you were completely not there. So, I mean, I'm just thinking here that, like, if the daughter says to you that, you know, my dad, Phil Spector, would like your music, and then Phil Spector hears it and thinks he could work with that music, did you go back and listen to the work that he had done, the famous Wall of Sound stuff, from Dion to the Ronettes to, I don't know, Ike and Tina Turner and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I think...
Did you do a crash course, like some homework?
Yeah. Obviously, I was already familiar. I'd been listening to Dion for quite a while, and John Lennon's Imagine, but I sort of dug out the Phil Spector box set. He sent us a box set. And
all right.
Like, started with Gene Pitney and the Teddy Bears and through to the Ronettes, and it's all great.
Mm. By the way, like, I mean, were you able to tell him, like, because he's not that au fait with current recording techniques, because he hasn't really been in too many studios, I would imagine, in the last 10 years. So, like, did he use Pro Tools? Were you able to tell him, like, this, that and the other, and this is how it's done these days?
He was reluctant to use Pro Tools because he isn't familiar with that kind of technology, so we'd kind of sneak it on a few times just in case he was having a bad day or whatever, so we'd sneak it on so he can change a few notes afterwards. But a lot of it was just pretty live, really.
Right. I mean, were you as amazed or surprised or saddened at the news of Phil Spector, like, very soon after working with you?
A really strange moment. Obviously, we never saw anything in his personality. He was always more like kind of a funny, old, eccentric kind of bloke. There was no... We'd have never thought that he'd do anything like that. And I don't know, it remains to be seen if he has, but...
It does. I mean, he's up on the murder rap and he has given his defence, so we'll see what happens next. And, like... The idea that you could be the very last band he's ever worked with, is that something that you realise is like a major note in the history books, or something that actually makes you feel pretty bad?
Mixed emotions, really. Mm. Obviously, it'd be a great thing and an honour to be the last band that Phil Spector worked with, but also it'd be a great loss to music that another great man has kind of fallen by the wayside in these circumstances. So,
Are you okay with the fact that, as I said earlier on, a lot of the publicity surrounding this album, in particular, I suppose, in the States, will centre around the fact that it's, you know, somebody who's very much in the news at the moment for all the wrong reasons, a legend?
It's slightly frustrating because as far as we're concerned, the rest of the album matches up to the tracks that we did with Phil Spector. But anything that gets people talking about Star Sailor and getting them interested in the band is good for us.
Right, okay, well listen, let's take one of the tracks anyway. This is the title track from the Star Sailor album, the second one. It's called Silence Is Easy.
Yeah, I don't think I'll play Silence Is Easy at the moment actually, because we're coming up towards 2 o'clock. So there you go, that's James Walsh from Star Sailor. So the legacy basically of Phil Spector, well, Phil Spector was a record producer, but maybe his real legacy was that basically of an indulged, washed up sociopath bordering on psychopath who once met an actress in a Los Angeles restaurant, brought her home, shot her and killed her. And 10 or 11 years into his 20-year jail sentence for the crime, he died behind bars this week of COVID-19. That's Phil Spector.
Dave Fanning, Weekends on 2FM.